heard on great radio stations all across America. It's The National Defense with Randy Miller and Jerry Newberry.
This is The National Defense. Randy Miller along with Jerry Newberry, Communications Director for the VFW. And Jerry, is always our dedication.
This show's for you, the men and women serving on active duty, Guard and Reserves, millions of veterans out there, and of course to all your families. We're here for you. We love you. God bless you.
And I noticed that Jerry is wearing a new suit, which means he must be interviewing the new national commander of the VFW, Glenn Gardner. Is that right?
That's right.
I knew it.
Yes.
He's on
good
the program
guess.
Along with, man, this is a great story. Silver Star recipient, Sergeant Gregory Scott Ruskey is going to be with us. And then Bill Murphy Jr., who's written a great book called In a Time of War. That is all coming up this hour in the National Defense. And you got an email that you wanted to get to.
I did, and it's from a G. Sutton. You're an 18- or 19-year-old kid. You're critically wounded and dying in the jungle in the Idrang Valley, 1965. LZ X-ray, Vietnam. Your unit is outnumbered 8-1, and the enemy fire is so intense from 100 and 200 yards away that your own commander has ordered the medevac copters to stop coming in. You're laying there listening to the enemy machine guns, and you know you're not getting out. Your family is halfway around the world, 12,000 miles away, and you'll never see them again. As the world starts to fade in and out, you know this is the day you die. Then over the machine gun noise, you faintly hear the sound of a helicopter, and you look up to see an unarmed Huey. But it doesn't seem real because no medevac markings are on it. Ed Freeman is coming for you. He's not medevac, so it's not his job, but he's flying his Huey down into the machine gun fire after the medevacs were ordered not to. He's coming anyway, and he drops in and sits there in the machine gun fire as they load two or three of you on board. Then he flies you up and out through the gunfire to the doctors and nurses, and he kept coming back 13 more times and took about 30 of you and your buddies out, who would never have gotten out if not for Ed.
Wow.
Medal of Honor recipient Ed Freeman died last Wednesday at the age of 80 in Boise, Idaho. May God bless his soul. And oh yeah, Paul Newman died that day too. I guess you knew that. He got a lot more press than Ed Freeman did.
We'll be right back here on the National Defense.
You're cleared for shore leave, sailor. Be back by the end of these messages.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
The Veterans of Foreign Wars believes in active allegiance to flag and country. Through legislative activism and service to our military forces, veterans, their families, and communities, freedom starts at home. Pledge your allegiance again. If you're a veteran and served overseas, you may be eligible to become a member of the nation's elite veterans organization, the Veterans of Foreign Wars.
You've served your country, now you can help your country serve others. Call 1-888-JOIN-VFW. That's 1-888-JOIN-VFW.
The following letters were written by our troops.
My dear fellow Americans, I truly appreciate your support. I was starting to wonder if people had forgotten about us over here, but then one of my buddies showed me this website, and now as tears are streaming down my face, I can see for sure that you haven't. Private Emily B., U.S. Army.
It's so heartwarming to see the American people not letting the men and women of the armed forces be forgotten. Your letters make a group of grown men, battle-hardened and gruff, act like a bunch of kids around a Christmas tree. Thanks. Staff Sergeant Matthew H., U.S. Army.
Your support may be the most important thing our troops can carry with them. But don't take our word for it. Take theirs. To show your support, visit americasupportsyou.mil. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Defense and the Ad Council.
I'm Jerry Newberry. You're listening to The National Defense. And with us today is newly elected national commander of the VFW, Glenn Gardner. How are you, Chief?
I'm great. How are you this morning, Jerry?
Hey, glad to see you.
Thank you.
You know, been wanting to do this interview for a while, but it's hard to catch up to you.
It's been a busy time since I was installed a little over a month ago.
You've been halfway around the world already and back.
Halfway around and back, yes, sir.
And we're going to talk about that. It's an interesting trip, and I want to touch on it. But, again, congratulations on your election as national commander. And, you know, it seems to me, after reading your bio and talking your way I have in years past, it seems like your entire adult life ended up where it was aimed at. I mean, for 40-some years, it's been VFW.
That's very true. I mean, I had a discussion with somebody a few minutes ago. It's my whole life has been devoted to this organization and to the veterans that we serve, and to be elevated to the position of Commander-in-Chief just means a lot to me. I think perhaps maybe even a lot more than it does to some others that have served in this position, because I have been dedicated to this organization and to our veterans for so many years.
And for those that don't know, Commander Gardner, National Commander Gardner, was the adjutant, Department of Texas, huge department, and you held that position for how many years?
For 22 years. 1984 to 2006.
And before that, leadership positions post-department levels?
I became active in this organization in 1974 and have held an office in the organization since 1975.
So you are uniquely qualified, and you're probably right, over and above some of your predecessors to hold this position.
Well, I think I'm very qualified. I've had the opportunity over the years to work on the National Bylaw Review Committee for 19 years. I had the opportunity to serve as the budget chairman for Commander-in-Chief Jim Nyer. I had the opportunity to be the adjutant quartermaster for a large department like Texas for 22 years. So all of that gave me a background and a foundation, I think, that helps me as I've served as the junior vice commander-in-chief, the senior vice commander-in-chief, and now the commander-in-chief for the Veterans of Foreign Wars.
As an adjunct to your position with the Department of Texas, you also chaired the Texas Committee for Veterans. Is that the correct title?
Or? It was Veterans Coalition.
Coalition.
We, 15 years ago, we felt a need in Texas to have a larger voice in state government and with issues having to do with veterans. So working together with leaders from other veterans organizations, we put together the Texas Coalition of Veterans Organizations.
How many veterans were in that coalition?
600,000 members.
Wow.
That we represented.
So when you guys spoke, people listened to you?
When we spoke, they listened. And yeah. I served as the chairman for 15 years.
That puts you in a position, you know how to get things done.
Well, it gave me the opportunity to testify before House and Senate in Texas, which was a large group, even though they only met every other year. But we had a lot of things that we passed. The veterans programs in Texas over the 20 years I was adjutant quartermaster went from a very small number of benefits to now we probably are one of the leading states when it comes to entitlements and programs that we have for veterans.
Well, let's talk about the VFW today.
Okay.
We've been around 109 years.
Right.
One of the most powerful organizations in the country, certainly one of the most powerful veterans organization in the world. But we're at a crossroads right now.
We definitely are.
So how do you plan on changing things? What's some of your strategy? What do we need to do as an organization?
Well, we have to refocus our attention on attracting these new young veterans to our organization, so that they can fill the leadership positions of the future. You know, we have basically a 40-year gap from the end of Vietnam to the beginning of the Gulf War, 30 years. So we've lost three generations of potential members to this organization. When I joined the organization, my father was a World War II veteran. I was a Vietnam veteran. Now, these young men and women that are serving today, Vietnam veterans are their grandfathers. So we've lost a lot of these
leaders. Thank you very much.
myself included. So, but we have to find a way. And the main concern that I have, what's going to happen to all these young men and women that are serving today, especially those that are being injured in combat, that need the VA facilities, that need the comp and pension, that need all of these entitlements 25 to 30 years from now, when there's not going to be 24 million veterans as there are today in the United States to stand up and speak out for them.
Right. And when the war's over with, when the shooting's done, and people get into that forgetful mode, because I mean, that's what's happened.
Sure.
Everyone wants to support the troops now, but when the shooting stops and the problems begin, the health issues, things like that, who's going to stand up for them?
As the old saying goes, you know, during time of conflict, God and country are well spoken of and soon forgotten. And that's what will happen. You know, we're very fortunate, and I know some that served in Vietnam that have joined our organization or tried to join our organization said the World War II veterans didn't treat them very well. It didn't matter how they treated us. It was the fact that there was 20 million of them who were always there, serving in Congress, there to help protect entitlements,
right.
And we just kind of hung on to the coattails, and we got the benefits that we enjoy today. So those people in Washington know there's 24 million veterans. We don't have 24 million in our organization. They know that. But they also know that as an organization of over 1,700,000, when we speak and when we put out the word, all veterans listen to us and start to react. But when we get 25 or 30 years from now, when there's not but about 6 or 7 million veterans in the whole United States, then it's going to be real easy for those people in Washington that control the purse strings to start tightening and cutting and tightening and cutting. And then these poor young men and women that are serving today are going to be in trouble.
Yeah, absolutely right. It wasn't that long ago. I mean, when you think back on the VA healthcare system as it was, the conditions that existed in some of the medical facilities were disgraceful. And we've come a long way, and it would be a shame to go backwards, to lose all that.
It really would. And these young men and women that are serving, as I visited with them overseas, I told them, I said, you need to join a veterans organization. That's your only salvation for the future. We are the best union that they have. As a member of the military, they can't join a union, but they can join the Veterans of Foreign Wars. And as a part of our organization, when we speak out on their behalf, then we're speaking out to make their way of life a lot better and their future a lot brighter. And that's the message that we have to get across to them, because they can't just sit here and let the veterans organizations die away and think that the people in Washington are always going to be as favorable as they are today, because
right.
It won't happen.
Absolutely right. Now, you've already done a lot of traveling, and I know one of your priorities for the year is to visit a number of military bases. Why do you want to do that?
Because I think the best way to talk to these young men and women is face-to-face and talk to the base commanders, talk to some of the chiefs, the E-8s, the E-9s on these different military installations, and try to get the message across so that they understand how important it is for them to join the Veterans of Foreign Wars or another veterans organization that they're qualified for. That's my priority. That's what we have to do.
But you're only one person. We have a lot of people in the military. So how does the organization as a whole reach out to this new generation?
Well, we have to find a way to rejuvenate our volunteer base so that they go to these different military bases, that they do the things that we have to do. We have to continue to find avenues for doing advertising, for participating in programs like our NASCAR program, things like that, to put our name out in front of the general public. It amazes me every time I sat down the other morning and breakfast with 12 E-8s and E-9s. One of them belonged to the VFW. All of them were eligible for the VFW. They knew little about the VFW. Later on that day, the E-9, who was the chief for one of the squadrons, I met with him personally, and he told me face-to-face, Glenn, I didn't realize how much the VFW did and how much we've done for veterans of this country. I mean, we've already given out over $3 million in grants in our unmet needs program to active duty military and their families. And we still have more money that's available. It's just remarkable as you travel around, Jerry, and you even when you deal with the VFW leaders of the post and departments, how little sometimes they know about some of the programs that we have in the organization, and they get literature on it all the time.
Yeah, it is amazing. So it's a matter of for us to reach that new generation, we pretty much have to go where they are. And I mean not just physically, but they communicate electronically now. That's where they get their information. So, you know, 21st century, we have to really move into that 21st century.
We definitely do. I think we found out, especially after Vietnam, that and even a little bit after Desert Storm, but we were lackadaisical in not reaching out to these young men and women, and like you and I, even when we were on active duty, nobody ever talked to me about the VFW. I just happened to join the VFW in Olathe, Kansas. But we have to reach out to these young men and women while they're on active duty, while you know you can look at them. And if they've got a medal on that qualifies them, you know they're eligible for the VFW. It makes your job a lot easier.
Sure.
I mean, I remember going out in the community after, in the, let's say, the late 70s, early 80s in Dallas, and going to a meeting for the Vietnam Veterans Memorial and sitting across the table from five or six Vietnam veterans who were big business people in Dallas, but unfortunately, because of the unpopular war that they had fought in, nobody ever knew they were Vietnam veterans till now they had become involved in this project. But it's that it just makes it a lot, our job a lot easier to reach out to them if we can just get the message to them while they're wearing that uniform.
So it's a matter of trying to move the entire organization forward, and that's got to be hard.
It is difficult. We've for so many years we've built our membership base on a contest mentality where you sign people up to win a contest. I've eliminated all membership contests. We're going to have, you know, we need to be signing people up because it's the right thing to do, not because I might win some prize for doing so. And if we can't convince our leaders that now's the time to do what's right for our organization and build a foundation for the future, we're doomed anyway. These contests don't work. They just encourage people to buy phony members. They don't help us with anything that we do. It costs us money because they don't want to be members anyway. Some of them are probably deceased. But we just have to get the leadership involved on all levels in doing what's right for the VFW and building that strong foundation so we can be here for another 100 years.
And I know you've moved forward and just by one thing. Your motto for this year.
Right.
Share that with us.
Honor, sacrifice, and service.
And those words are very powerful words. And those are words that, not just your motto, should be the motto.
The whole organization.
Right.
Everything that we do is built on the honor of our service, the sacrifice, and the service that we continue to give to this great nation, to the veterans. You know, as the old saying goes, a country that forgets its veterans will soon be forgotten.
Right.
And we just have to bring that forward. Are we going to have less members in the future than we have today? Sure. It's for, you know, there's no doubt about it because we're not going to have the veterans of the future. We've been in Iraq now for, what's almost 6 years, longer than Vietnam. In Vietnam, we created 8 million eligible veterans for this organization. We haven't created 2 million yet.
Right.
Out of Iraq and Afghanistan because these young men and women keep going back time and
right.
time again. So, but that doesn't mean that we're going to be any less of an organization. We can do just as much with less if we all work together and if we have more active members and if we'll all reach out to our congressmen, our representatives, and let them know that we expect them to continue to help us.
Right, and you know, a good analogy for that is the Marine Corps.
That's true.
You're a former Marine. And,
few good men.
Yeah, that's right. It's, you know, one of the smallest branches of the service, but nobody's going to dispute the fact what the Marine Corps does.
That's
for
true.
Sure. And yeah, it's a good model.
Right.
Your travels. Just got back from Asia.
Yes.
You went to China, and this trip was important in what respect? It's somewhat historic, right?
Historic. This is our third year to go to China, but it was our best year. Some people say, well, why do you go to China? Well, we go anywhere that we need to go to carry the MIA issue so that it will be resolved for the families that still have loved ones missing from World War II, from Korea, from Vietnam, from any other conflict in between. We went to China. We had the opportunity to meet. I had the opportunity to meet with the defense minister and let them know, number one, that we appreciate the fact that we're going to open their archives to us. Now, there are those in the military that say we're probably not going to learn much more out of the archives than what we already know, but at least it's a start. But to also ask that if they would intervene on our behalf with North Korea. We have thousands of, about 8,000 MIAs still in North Korea. We know where a lot of them are. A lot of them are buried in the Chosen in different areas. If they would just let us in there, let our teams go in there and get the remains of our young men and women, young men back out of there, it would be great. We appreciate it, and the families would appreciate it. And we still have many, you know, thousands from World War II that are unaccounted. I mean, almost 80,000
right.
MIAs altogether, and we just need to work to solve that problem. So that's why it's important that we go to China. I'm going to Russia next week for the same reason, because those are two of the keys to solving this. We then went into Korea and Japan, visited with the military.
And you mentioned Japan and the military assistance program, some new initiatives in Japan. Is that correct?
In Korea and Japan. In Osan, Korea, at the Family Readiness Center, we've set up an unmet needs program. We're funding it with $25,000. We're also doing it at Yokota in Japan. Any active duty military, their family that needs financial assistance can go to the Family Center and request help. We're not like some of the other organizations that will loan it to you and you pay us back. This is a cash grant for emergency airline ticket for somebody that's sick, maybe just doesn't come under the normal course of getting your way paid home. We can take care of it. Or maybe you have an emergency in your family and your wife, spouse back in the States needs some financial help. We're there to do that.
And, you know, today it's very easy to forget that we have troops in other places in the world besides Iraq or Afghanistan. Number of troops in Korea, number of troops all over the world.
Right.
And Korea can be particularly hard on a military family, right?
Yeah, it's, yeah. You know, we're Korean at about 30,000. They're talking about increasing that. They're redeploying. They're going to have They're moving everybody south down to Camp Humphreys. They're rebuilding that base. They're going to have Osans where the Air Force is. The Air Force also has some bases south of Osan. But, you know, I think people forget that we're operating under a truce in
right.
South Korea. We have no peace treaty.
Right.
I mean, we basically, North and South Korea were at war, signed a truce, and they quit fighting. That's where we are today.
And the great leader, North Korea, he's not exactly screwed on real tight to start with.
No, he's not. The people up there are not in the best shape. They're almost
desperate.
I'm sure they look across that border and see that their counterparts in the South have much more than they do.
Right.
And I found it very interesting that the South has actually built a complex in North Korea, an industrial complex right across the border where they're manufacturing items and using North Korean labor along with some of the South Korean labor to manufacture items there.
Well, hopefully one of these days that whole situation will be resolved. But until then, it's good to know the VFW is there helping out.
Well, and
I mean, that's what we do. That's what we do so well.
That's what
we do the best.
That's right. And when I was in Osan, I was the principal speaker for MIA POW program. It was at 3 o'clock on Friday afternoon and started at 3 o'clock on Thursday afternoon. They started carrying the POW MIA flag around the base, and they ran it around the base constantly for 24 hours. And then at 3 o'clock on Friday, they brought it into the chapel where the program was held. And it was a moving experience to see these young men and women that care that much about those comrades that are still missing. It's great to see it. You know, and everybody that has served in Korea and is serving in Korea is eligible for the Veterans of Foreign Wars. And I found many of them that didn't realize that, many high-ranking officials, officers, and staff NCOs that didn't understand they were eligible for the VFW. So we try to carry that message with us. And as I said, just let them know how it is, important it is for them to belong to a veterans organization.
Okay, I'm going to give you a couple seconds here because we have to get going. I know you're really busy.
No problem.
If you could say one thing to our military people, what would it be? And also, if you had an opportunity to give one message to a veteran of our military, what would it be?
Well, I think the thing, Jerry, I would say is, you know, we all have been comrades in arms, those that are serving today and those of us that served in the past. And all of us that have served realize the importance of the benefits and the entitlements that everybody earned. The entitlements that are in place today that I enjoy and that Vietnam veterans enjoy and Korean veterans of World War II, they're not going to change that much drastically before we pass away. But I can assure those young men and women serving today that if they don't join a veterans organization so that they can speak together with one loud voice 25 to 30 years from now, they're going to see a lot of their comrades in arms that came back drastically wounded from Iraq and Afghanistan. They won't have any place to go. They'll have no hospitals. They need their help. They need to join a veterans organization. They need to be part of the solution for the problems of the future.
Right on. Hey, Glenn, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Jerry. I appreciate it.
This is Jerry Newberry. We've been speaking with Glenn Gardner, National Commander of Veterans of Foreign Wars of the United States. This is the National Defense.
The only truth you'll hear on the radio, the National Defense.
In a military warehouse south of Washington, D.C., a USO stuffing party is in full swing. By the end of the day, volunteers will have stuffed over 10,000 USO care packages, packed them in boxes, loaded them on trucks, and sent them on their way to our soldiers in Iraq, Afghanistan, and military bases around the world. They'll stuff them full of things that most of us take for granted, but that our troops don't often have. Things like toiletries, playing cards, candy, books, little things. Little things that carry an enormous message to our troops. Little things like, thank you. Like, we'll never forget you. Like, we're behind you 100%. Like, we love and cherish each and every one of you. Little things. We're all about the little things. We're the USO. So are you. For more information and to find out how you can help, visit us at USO.org. The USO. Until everyone comes home.
Big Brothers Big Sisters presents 100 Years of Helping Kids.
Today, Kyle and his big brother Justin,
hello,
hi,
are here to share some stuff we've learned.
With kids, it's not always what you say, but how you say it.
Hey Kyle, you want to go to a foreign film festival?
Nah, that's boring.
Okay.
Hey Kyle, you want to go to a foreign film festival?
Yeah, that's a great idea.
From time to time, a kid may double dare you.
Wow, that looks heavy. Bet you can't lift it.
Are you serious?
I double dare you.
Okay.
See? I told you! Uh-oh.
Moments like these happen every day.
Making a big difference in the life of a child. To find out the many ways you can help support kids in your community, call 1-888-412-BIGS or go to BigBrothersBigSisters.org.
That's BigBrothersBigSisters.org.
This message brought to you by Big Brothers Big Sisters and the Ad Council.
Until next time.
Welcome back to National Defense. Randy Miller along with Jerry Newberry. And Jerry, you came in crying this morning. What's up with you?
Well, I stayed up last night reading until my eyeballs bled. I picked up a book, and it's one of those rare publications that you pick up and you read a page or two,
right?
And you just know it's one of those rare gems out there that you can't put down.
Well, first, people should know we get any type of military book that's ever published, we get.
Right.
I mean, that's it.
Right.
You know, it comes across the desk. You take a look at, and because the reverse is true too. You can read a couple of pages and go, I will never look at this book again.
And I do that more frequently than not. Right. You know, there's a lot of stuff out there.
Yeah.
This book, Randy, titled In a Time of War, it's about the West Point class of 2002, a small group of those graduates. And I'm telling you, and this is no exaggeration, it is... I believe it is one of the most compelling and poignant books I've ever read in my life. It actually made me cry as I read part of it.
Well, the author, Bill Murphy Jr., is on with us right now. Bill, how are you?
I'm great, guys. Wow, I really appreciate you saying those things. You know, but the focus shouldn't be on me. It's on these men and women that have served and have... you know, and it, I mean, it's their stories. It's, you know, I just edited for clarity and content, so to speak. It's all about them.
Well, you did the interviews too, though. I mean, you
oh,
really.
Oh no, I do. I mean, that's a little bit self-deprecating, I guess.
It's a lot self-deprecating because you did more than editing. I mean, you brought these people immediately. You know, I was immediately connected to this group of people. I felt like I knew them. And one of the main people in your book, Todd Bryant, when you told the story of him becoming a casualty, that, I'm telling you, I bawled like a baby.
Wow. Well, I'll tell you, I had a lot of moments where I did when I was learning about him and getting to know him and writing those parts of it. And, you know, I mean... here's the thing, you know, we all serve. Everybody in America wants to find their way to serve. And in all humility, this was a way for me to serve. You know, I'd been in the Army, but I had a fairly undistinguished career. No, this was my chance, and it was to get to know someone like Todd Bryant, some of these other people, Drew Sloan, who maybe we'll get a chance to talk about, who have given everything they have for this country. And, you know, my goal in doing that, it was to tell a great story, yes, but there are... a lot of people in this country who just don't have a connection to the military, who don't have that experience, who don't know soldiers. And what I wanted to do was get to know some of these people well enough that they would feel like they knew them. And then maybe, you know, the next time they see a name in the newspaper or they see video of a soldier in Afghanistan or Iraq or when they're walking through the airport like we do and we see these young guys and women wearing that camouflage, a little bit rumpled after a 15-hour flight from Kuwait, it might, you know... just walk up and say thanks, because they might laugh, they might kind of give you a little nervous, you know, human reaction, but I'm telling you, they appreciate it and they deserve it.
We're talking to Bill Murphy Jr. He's the author of In a Time of War, about the West Point class of 2002. And Bill, I wanted to ask you, what surprised you about meeting these different officers and these different families that you interviewed? Was there something that surprised you? Maybe not that you went in with, you know, any kind of preconception about these folks, but was there something that stood out where you said, "Wow, I'm really amazed by this"?
Yeah, no, I mean, there are so many things. I think I came to it with my own experience, just being an American and having some military experience, and I thought this will probably be a book about a class with quote-unquote perfect timing that, mm-hmm. you know, happened to graduate just at the start of the Iraq War, and I thought there'd be a lot of combat in the book. And I mean, there is a lot of combat, but what surprised me about where they led me was they led me to talk to their wives and girlfriends and husbands back in the States, and to talk to their families about how they serve as well.
Right.
And then, you know, the thing that really surprised me, and I almost blush when I say it now, but it surprised me the degree to which this is really a book about love, about the number of times that they told me that what motivates them is love for their country, love for the soldiers that serve under them, love for the people that are with them. And, you know, they don't always talk that way, but sometimes you can hear it in their voice, even when they're talking about how, you know, we got the order to walk over there and pick up the remnants of that IED, and I was afraid it was booby-trapped or it would go off again. And I said, I'm not letting my guys do it. I'm going to do it myself. Why? Wow. Because they cared about their soldiers. They didn't want to have unnecessary risks on them, and they'd rather take them themselves.
Right. And you know, you set out with certain goals. You certainly accomplished those goals and more, and you brought up something very important. It's not just the story of the graduates, class of 2002. But it's such a great story about the families. And you know, too often the families are forgotten about. And, you tell a story so well of the impact that before they're called to be deployed, the feelings there and while they're deployed and certainly the aftermaths of the result of their deployments, you do it so well. And another thing that's so great about this book is story of when you speak of love, the love this group of people, these classmates, had for each other. And here they were after they graduated, went through the rigors of West Point, which, it's not an easy thing to graduate from West Point. Yeah. There they are dispersed. They're all, scattered around the world. And but yet they're so connected, even though those miles kept them apart.
Yeah, they are. And, when bad things happen, and they do, I mean, and it unfolded in real time for me because, I got to know some of these people who were then casualties, obviously not as well as I would have liked to have known them because it's the nature of war. But when that did happen, you had people flying in from all over the world to be with them, to be with their families, to say that, I've been 8,000 miles away and we haven't seen each other in person for a couple of years, but it's in the 21st century, people do have an easier time of keeping in touch over email and things like that, and these bonds definitely they survive years and miles and war and all sorts of human emotions. So that definitely struck me.
And now you're connected to all those people. There's got to be a bond there, right?
Yeah, honestly, that's a huge privilege. That's a huge honor as a result of this, that I'm still in contact with some of these people as often, if not more so, than I was when I was writing the book. I'm actually at West Point right now, and, this weekend I'll be sticking around for a football game and going with some of the members of the O2 class that'll be coming back here just for this weekend. And as I've had a chance to travel for this book, wherever I go, I was, one of the characters, Drew Sloan, who was injured in Afghanistan, recovered, and went to Iraq. He's out of the Army up at Harvard Business School now, and I was up there just recently and got to see him for a little while and tease him about the fact that he now has longer hair and more stylish clothes than I do.
than the reporter, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I'm supposed to be the shaggy hair civilian, and he's the one who looks like... looks like he just came from MTV, but no, they're great people, and I consider them friends, and that's a great honor.
Now, you spent some time yourself, boots on the ground in Iraq, correct?
I did. I went over as a reporter for the Washington Post in the early months of 2007, and I was embedded with units in 1st Cav and 25th ID for most of the time that I was there. That was essential to writing this book. A lot of reporters have spent a lot more time there than I have, but I think... just the experience of even for that short matter of a couple of weeks into a little over a month to be able to, be with soldiers, see what they go through, at least in that snapshot in time, gave me just a better appreciation for what I was writing about and an ability to describe things.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
I want to find out, was that a more dangerous mission than working as Bob Woodward's research assistant?
Yeah, it depends where he sent me, right?
Yeah, right. You were the research assistant on his book,
The White House,
State of
the
Denial.
Bush?
Yeah.
I worked on State of Denial, which was quite an experience. Just a fantastic, interesting, intellectual experience,
right?
Just wonderful to be able to talk to some of the people that I was able to talk to as a result of that, and hear firsthand. This book that I'm doing now is different from a Woodward book in a number of ways, and one of them is just the focus where Bob's going to write about Washington, and I thought, no, I'm going to try and write about the boots on the ground. But I'll tell you, the one thing I took from it from working for Bob was, you've never done enough interviews. It's you've never listened quite long enough, and you'll always find something interesting out if you stick around a little longer or, stay in that hotel one more night so you can do the interview the next day. You'll find amazing stuff if you give people enough time to talk.
You got anything else in the works?
I'm switching gears a little bit, and I'm actually working on a book on the Harvard Business School.
Oh, well, we're running out of time here.
I appreciate it.
Just
if I can give a quick plug, we have a website,
Okay.
www.inatimeofwar.com, and we've got the first chapter of the book there along with a three-minute video that they did such a great job of just it sets the tone for the book and introduces you to a couple of the characters. Inatimeofwar.com.
Yeah, if for all you out there listening, if you're going to read a book, if you're only going to read one book in the next 5 years, make it this one.
Wow.
Yeah,
wow.
I'm telling
That's quite the endorsement, Bill.
Yeah, I'm telling you.
I'm humbled, but I obviously really appreciate that. This is, these people put a lot into it as well, and they trusted me, so I greatly appreciate that.
Well, it's just speaking from the heart. Hey, Bill, thanks for being with us, and great job. And, hey, do us a favor. This weekend, while you're at West Point enjoying the football game with the class of 2002, pass along our best regards to them and our appreciation for everything they've
absolutely.
Done for us.
I'll do that, absolutely.
All right. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Bill Murphy Jr. In a Time of War is the name of the book. We'll be right back here on the National Defense.
Stay tuned for more of the National Defense after this.
The VFW is looking for a few more heroes. The largest combat veterans organization in America wants to get you involved and keep you active. With nearly 2 million members and 9,000 posts around the country, the VFW is doing the tough job of supporting our troops. You can be a part of all the excellent programs that keep the fires burning on the front lines. Programs such as Operation Uplink, with phone cards for active duty and hospitalized veterans, Adopt a Unit, which provides assistance for nearly 1,000 military units, and care package efforts for the troops serving in Iraq and Afghanistan. Only someone who's been there can understand what it means to be remembered. The VFW has been the heart and soul of the military for over 100 years. Isn't it time you stake your claim as a veteran? Call the VFW Membership Department at 1-888-JOIN-VFW or log on to VFW.org for more details. You've served your country. Now you can help your country serve others. Call 1-888-JOIN-VFW. That's 1-888-JOIN-VFW.
What do you want from the Wizard of Oz?
Just messing with you. But seriously, people don't want to stand in front of my big, awesome wizard head and hear me going, duh. They want answers. That's why I go to USA.gov, the official source for government info. It gives me the smarts to go with the show. Say someone asks for a brain. I go to USA.gov, type in student loans, and 4 years later, they're chock full of knowledge. Is the Wicked Witch terrorizing your neighborhood? Well, move. Then search USA.gov for change of address form so your friends can find you and the witch can't. How about if you're stuck here from Kansas and want to go home? Well, check out USA.gov for the latest travel restrictions and passport applications. I even use it for myself. Bought my sweet ride at a government auction I found on USA.gov. I call it
the Wizmobile.
Balloons are for squares.
For federal and state government information, there's no place like USA.gov.
Welcome back to National Defense. Randy Miller along with Jerry Newberry. And, you know, we've talked about different things this morning as far as the book that we were talking about with Bill Murphy in A Time of War, where he talks to some West Point attendees in 2002 that went on to become heroes.
Right.
We get the real deal here.
We do.
We get the real deal.
Absolutely.
Sergeant Gregory Scott, and it's Rusky, right?
That is correct.
And Scott, first of all, congratulations. Jerry, talk about what has happened here.
Well, Scott is a Silver Star recipient, member of the Army Reserve, and his Silver Star is the nation's third highest award for valor.
Wow.
And I have your citation here, your summary of action, Scott, and it's quite a feat, heroism.
Oh, well, I had lots of help. Well, I hope it says all that on there, too.
Can you kind of take us through what happened and some of the events leading up to that action?
Did you want the nice and short version?
Oh, I don't know, just whatever version you want to give.
Okay, we were conducting a joint patrol with some Afghan police officers, And we were out in this area where gun trucks couldn't really get to us, because anyone familiar with Afghanistan knows it's really tough terrain to get around in. It's one road if you're lucky. So we were on the foot patrol out out in the Afghania Valley when we were passing by this compound. It's mostly farm fields and whatnot, and we had gotten ambushed from a hill to our right, and in that opening barrage, one Afghan officer was hit in his forearm, and the other one was hit several times, and he pretty much slumped to the ground, and we thought he was pretty much dead. And I was pulling up rear security, and so I ran to the corner of the building, and the rest of the guys that were with us took cover in this shallow ditch. And as I was launching my 203 and firing my rifle, trying to suppress anything that looked suspicious at that time, which was everything to me, I noticed the dirt kicking up next to their heads and body and whatnot, and it was really accurate fire because it was coming within 3 to 6 inches of these guys.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I looked over to my buddy, and I said, I think you guys are in a bad spot. And at that point, they picked up and started peeling out and took cover in this little orchard, walled orchard, that was next to this compound. And at that point, we had our TERP, because I asked my squad leader for permission to try and get up on the roof so I could maybe get a better angle on these guys. Mm-hmm. And we had our TERP negotiate our entrance into this building while the squad leader and LT were trying to get air support on and QRF launched and all that. And so once we got onto the roof, it was me, Specialist Seagraves, my buddy, and Captain Monholland. The way it works is they have their roof where they live, but the wall still goes up at like another 7 feet.
Hmm.
So that and the foliage was really thick, so I wasn't able to really see much, but apparently they could see me quite well.
And that's where you got hit.
That's correct. Captain Monholland had gone down the ladder. Specialist Seagraves was about to go. Then everything started blowing up around me from where the rounds were hitting. And Specialist Seagraves jumped off the roof, and I felt something, like felt like a rubber band, thwapped me in my hip. And so I hit the ground hit his roof, and I reached back with my glove, and it was all numb. And I looked at my hand, and I saw there was blood on it, and I was like, okay, well, obviously the roof is not a good place for me to be.
Yeah.
So I proceeded to get off of there, and I'd moved back to the corner where I'd originally taken cover, and I noticed that the Afghan police officer was, in fact, still alive, and he was trying to crawl towards us. And so we had my buddy, the saw gunner, Specialist Reed, I asked him to do a nice little Z pattern on that mountain where we were taking our fire, and Sergeant First Class Hopkins was also going to try and suppress for us, and me and a Specialist Seagraves, we counted to three. They opened fire. We ran out there and grabbed the guy by his arms and dragged him back. But we were going to pull him into that comp, the orchard, the walled orchard, and Seagraves grabbed his arms and I grabbed his legs. And what I didn't realize was that the round that hit him in the leg had shattered his femur. So when I went to pick up his legs, one stayed normal and the other one folded in half the wrong way.
Wow.
And so that guy started screaming because that got his attention, sure, and mind as well. But
yeah,
we managed to get him inside where we had our combat lifesavers bags, and we were all trained on that. So we got a tourniquet on him, and he was still bleeding rather profusely despite all that. And there was a problem with radio fill, like someone was on an old fill or something was messed up to where we couldn't get air support to fire. I mean, it was flying around, but we couldn't get in contact with the pilots. So there's a lot of things that didn't turn out that well, but the fact that we all managed to walk out on our own.
Right. Here's what happened. You were hit in the hip.
Right.
The round exited your back. So that's a pretty serious wound. You and your buddy... and you're still getting fired on. You ignored the fire, and you managed to sprint about 30 meters to drag this AMP to safety. And you provided him first aid, rejoined the battle, and stayed in the fight for more than 3 hours.
Oh, my gosh.
Until those supporting elements could reach your position and do a medevac.
Yeah.
So... You're downplaying it a little bit. It's by the way, Scott has earned the distinction of being the Army Reserve's fourth Silver Star recipient.
Okay, wow.
Only four.
Wow.
Three before him. So it's quite a hero, Scott. And, it's an amazing feat.
And again, Army Reserve. You know, like we've said many, many times on this program, there is no such thing.
So General Stultz presented you with the star yet?
That's going to be on the 23rd in Orlando.
Okay.
At the Senior Leaders War Conference.
All right.
And how are you doing, Scott?
I'm doing great. Taking in the sights at DC.
But I mean, physically, you're fine.
Oh yeah, it hit nothing but meat. So it was probably the luckiest shot in history on that Taliban's part for actually hitting me, and lucky on my part because it didn't hit bone or anything.
And lucky for us that you're serving our country. Thank you so much for your service.
Welcome home.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much, and congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Scott. Wow, that's some big stuff.
Yeah.
And we do a little radio show. But we do it every week, and we'll be right back here next week on the National Defense. Thanks for listening.
I never thought that this is where I'd settle down. I thought I'd die an old man back in my hometown. They gave me this plot of land, me and some other men, for a job well done. There's a big white house, sits on a hill just up the road. The man inside, he cried the day they brought me home. They folded up a flag and told my mom and dad, we're proud of your son. And I'm proud to be on this peaceful piece of property. I'm on sacred ground and I'm in the best company. I'm thankful for those, thankful for the things I've done. I can rest in peace, I'm one of the chosen ones. I made it to Arlington. I remember Daddy brought me here when I was eight. We searched all day to find out where my granddad lay. And when we finally found that cross, he said, son, this is what it cost to keep us free. Now here I am, 1,000 stones away from him. He recognized me on the first day I came in, and it gave me a chill when he clicked his heels and saluted me. And I'm proud to be on this peaceful piece of property. I'm on sacred ground and I'm in the best of company. I'm thankful for those, thankful for the things I've done. I can rest in peace, I'm one of the chosen ones. I made it to Arlington. And every time I hear 21 guns, I know they brought another hero home.